This is the Athletic Hockey Show Prospect Series.
Hey everybody, Max Boltman here alongside Corey Pronman for another episode of the Athletic Hockey Show's Prospect Series. Corey, you have been grinding. It is your busy season. A couple of big articles from you out this week. Your gorgeous new draft rankings, which I would really encourage people to go check out. I don't think Corey did the coding himself, but maybe I'm wrong. But
no, I did not.
Very cool. It's super cool interactive ranking. I think you're going to love it if you haven't seen it already. And then Mock Draft 2.0, which I can't say Mock Draft 2.0 and not start there. I think the listeners would revolt, Corey. So let's get right into that. What are, in your mind, kind of the big changes here from edition 1.0?
Right at the top, it's that I think the really strong ploy of Leo Carlson at the World Championships, I would have been between mocking Will Smith from the U.S. program or him at the 3 spot. And I think Leo Carlson is now at the 3 spots following his really strong play down the middle for Sweden at the World Championships. And frankly, I think you could even argue him up to number 2. I think, you know, that's not where he is on my personal big board, but I think there's a lot of people in the league who are really enamored with this player. And I think Anaheim, at the minimum, has to have a very serious conversation about him at 2. So I think that is one of the biggest changes there. And the end result is Will Smith goes at 4 to San Jose. I mocked Nate Danielson at 7. And I think he was either like 10 or 11 last time. And I think trying to find his landing spot's been a little difficult. I know there are some teams in the league who are a little, you know, not as optimistic on him as I am. But I know there are some teams in the league who are major fans of this player and think he will go that high in the draft, whether it's 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, somewhere in that range. And try to find his exact landing spot, you know, with another center high up there, Dalibor Dvorsky. You know, in my experience, premium centers and premium defense prospects go very fast. So it's just a matter of the right spot, whether it's Philadelphia, Washington, Detroit, St. Louis, Vancouver. I kind of feel like somewhere in that area he is going to go. But the big question remains Matvei Michkov. And like in the first mock, he goes at 8 to Washington. I haven't gotten any extremely new information to change that projection. I think there are people in the league who still think he's going to slide. I did see that great interview that TVA did with various people from the SKA organization about Michkov. But from my conversations all year with hockey people, I have some reservations he's going to go where his talent dictates he should go with an extremely premium pick. But we will see in a couple of weeks what happens there. And the other, but that being said, I still have 2 Russians going fairly early in Daniel Boot and Dmitry Simashev. So I don't think there is complete reservation within the league on Russians. I just think like that high in the draft, you're talking premium names and guys who you, if you pick at 4, 5, 6, you are picking a guy you think could be an impact player for your organization. I just don't know for sure if teams are going to take that dive, but I could be wrong. Like I'm not. I don't know what San Jose, Montreal, Arizona, Philadelphia is going to do. Maybe if we get closer to the draft, the information will get a little bit better. Teams have either just had their meetings or are still in the process of having meetings, so I don't have extremely good information yet on that front. But that's, I would say, one of the still the big mysteries of the draft is how Michkov will dictate the top 10.
We went in depth on Michkov and that whole situation last week, which I'd strongly encourage people to go listen to with Corey and Chris Peters, giving some really good context to all this. But Corey, when you talk about that uncertainty in that alleyway, you know, maybe it's at San Jose at 4, although there's still kind of that sense that Will Smith maybe is worth that distinction. But when you get into Montreal, Arizona, Philly, we talk all the time on this show about how trades in this range do not happen, but it does seem like that it has to be an option you're strongly considering if you're those teams.
Yeah, I think any team, you know, from 10 to 15, 10 to 20, I think they need to have a plan in place if they are prepared to take that risk. I think that's the thing that I've noticed in the league. Like, I can't tell you where Mitchkov is going to go. I wish I knew, because that would be really useful information to report. but I don't know. But what I can say is I know there are organizations in the league that are squeamish on the idea of taking him up the very high pick. I know there are organizations in the league that would be very excited to do that. And I just don't know where, say, Montreal, San Jose, Arizona, Philly, or even, well, I think Washington have a fairly good idea. But those organizations, I don't know where they land on that question. And I just think if you're picking a little bit later, I think you are one of those organizations that would be really excited to get that player. I think you need to have a plan in place to potentially go up and get him, because he's a rare type of offensive talent. And I would say, given the uniqueness of this draft, where you have, several premium names, a couple of more than usual, whereas, in last year's draft, you're talking about, oh man, do I got to trade to number one overall to go get this guy? And maybe Slepkovsky goes, do I need to go up to two to get this guy? You can get up to maybe five or six to get this guy in this draft. So, and he's a very, unique offensive talent, not a great skater, not that big. We've been over that before, but like I said, I think it presents a unique opportunity for an organization picking in the teens to somehow acquire a player of this caliber.
Yeah. Let's go back to one of the first things you said with this mock, which was Leo Carlson's kind of post-world championship rise. You mentioned he's at three here to Columbus. I want to know, how serious is the idea that this could be someone Anaheim even considers at two, which would, for Columbus, totally change the game?
Yeah, I still, again, with mock drafts, part of it is what are you hearing in the league, but part of it is player evaluation too. Like, I think at some point you have to stop believing all the rumors you hear and just look at the players and ask yourself, does it make sense? And I just see an Adam Fantilli. I see a 6'2 center who can skate, who has incredible offensive abilities. He led college hockey in scoring this season, won the Hobey Baker, and he's this big, highly competitive, super physical centerman. I get Leo Carlson is smarter. I would give him a higher hockey sense grade. Pretty much every NHL scout I talked to would agree with that. Maybe he has a little bit more pure offense in his game. I get that argument, but I just look at the two players and it doesn't make sense to me to not take that player.
And I think especially when you factor in, I think we've made this point on a previous podcast, that Pat Verbeek is the GM who's going to make that decision. The way that Pat Verbeek was as a player, and certainly the way a lot of the teams that he's been a part of with Steve Yzerman, they do seem to emphasize that compete trait that Fantilli has over Carlson. Not to say that Carlson doesn't compete, but that is one of Fantilli's true strengths.
Right. I think, given that, I would say Carlson, I don't think he was miles better than Fantilli at the Worlds, but I would say if you had to ask me who was the better of the two players there, I would have said Carlson, although Fantilli's goal there in the semifinal may have swayed that opinion a little bit, just given the moment and the caliber of play that was. But if you looked at the body of the work, I would say Carlson over the tournament was a little bit more impressive, but I don't think it was enough to outweigh everything I've seen of them over the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I still think of doing a mock draft, for me, I still think Fantilli will be the second pick.
When we did it, we had Scott on last time to discuss you and his kind of joint mock draft. I did hear from the Detroit fans about skipping over all the analysis of the potential Detroit selections. I think there's a natural lane to do it here, because in this, they've got 9-17. You've got them coming away with Dalibor Dvorsky and Zach Benson. Benson, we've talked the whole year about kind of how tough it's going to be to figure out where is this guy going to go, because there is obvious, a lot to like there, but he is this smaller skilled winger, and we tend to see that player drop in the draft. Here he gets a 17. What kind of went into trying to figure out a landing spot for Zach Benson?
Well, it's a couple of things. Like I said, smaller winger, not an elite skater, obviously has a ton of skill, hockey sense, competitiveness, but you start looking at the organizations where he might land in. And I start looking at, will Washington take him at 8? Maybe. Obviously, Mitchkov is, between him and Mitchkov, I think they're going Mitchkov. At 9 is Detroit. I think he fits a lot of what they want to do, but I just feel like they would want to get a guy that's a little bit bigger. Now you're looking for ideally a center or a defenseman. At 10 with Vancouver, can they really go with another wing? You know, they just, you know, Vasily Podkolzin and John Lekaromäki, Nils Höglander. Eventually, I think you need to get either some size or a center or a D prospect. They don't get center or D in this mock draft. They get Matthew Wood. Arizona, I think, would like to get bigger. Buffalo have drafted a lot of small forwards recently in the draft. St. Louis has drafted a lot of wingers lately in the draft. I think Pittsburgh is a potential landing spot there. That would make a lot of sense to give, you know, Malkin or Crosby a potential scoring option. But, you know, I give him Gabe Perreault, who I think between Perreault and Benson, I think Perreault would go higher in the draft if the draft was held today. So those are all the variables that I'm kind of balancing when trying to figure out a landing spot for this player. And I could see with two firsts, Detroit being an organization that's been willing to take that kind of swing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think at nine, maybe it's a little rich for their blood, especially when you look at kind of what else is there. I think in this one, Dvorsky, I do think is another one who fits what they want to do. Tom Molander at 10. But at 17, you start to get there and you see the offensive tools plus the compete. There's a lot there to certainly for the Red Wings to like. The one that, the three guys on the board there, one after another, really four, Barlow, Moore, Jaeger, all I think could be kind of interesting questions for them. So that should be an interesting, it's a really interesting draft for Detroit just because of the two picks in the top 17.
I think the landing spots of Boot and Simashev can dictate things there too. The more I kind of ask around the league, I think both of them will be fairly high picks. I'm not sure if they both go top 15 or top 20, but I think there's a lot of interest in both of those players. But if they go low, I have them both going in the top 15 in this mock. I think in the last mock, I had them going a little bit lower. Those two landing spots can change things significantly.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right here, hear from our sponsors, and we're going to continue with this conversation in just 1 second.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, let's dive back into this, Corey. I want to talk to you about the defenseman in this class because you talk about Tom Molander and his rise. We've talked about that on this show. He gets up to 10 in this mock. But by the end of the first round, it's still only, I believe, seven defensemen that you have going in round one. And a good chunk of those are right there at the very back half, back 5 to 10 picks, which is still a little bit striking when we talk about the first round of a draft and how valuable defensemen are to NHL teams.
Yeah, I agree. I think figuring out the defenseman slotting for this year's class is a challenging thing. And just because, again, the position is so highly valued, and it's why I still have four defensemen going, I believe, in the top 15 to 16 picks of this draft. Two in the top 10 in David Reinbacher and Tom Molander. Two more in the early teens in Dmitry Simashev and Axel Sandin-Pelikka. Then after that, there is a gap. And it makes me wonder, now that you point that out, like I think there's about an 11-12 spot gap between Sandin-Pelikka and the next defenseman that gets picked, which I believe was Etienne Morin. You know, I know there are big fans in the league of Oliver Bunk. I know there are big fans in the league of Morin. I know there are big fans in the league of a couple other defensemen, be it Tanner Mullendick or Maxim Sturback. And so I look at that and I wonder, maybe I should be elevating those players a little bit. Kind of what you said, we've known for a while this is a forward-heavy draft, and guys have emerged during the course of the season, and I think still that it is kind of forward-heavy. There will be guys that will just be elevated for that reason. It's not taking a guy who is less talented than the other options, but if you value really premium on the defense position, and there's only a few left, and there's 5-6 other wingers, especially if you're a team with multiple picks. You know, if you have 6-7 forwards you're really excited about, and you have another pick 10-15 picks later, and there's only one defenseman left you're really excited about, I think teams will opt for that defenseman.
Yeah, it is interesting, though, because when you look at some of the teams that have multiple picks here, like in your mock, you know, Nashville, St. Louis at 24, 25, those teams are both on their second pick of the draft. And in your mock, they both went D with their first pick. So you can easily see how they end up in this mock. I think it's David Edstrom and Quentin Musty to those spots. That plays a factor here, too. I mean, certainly you can see teams take two defensemen, but it makes you kind of understand, especially if the talent leans for the forward, you probably feel better about making that pick.
Yeah, I think for those organizations like Nashville, like St. Louis, like Arizona, who don't really have that defense prospect in their organization, I think if you're looking at this draft, where their picks are, you're probably thinking to yourself, like, we should ideally be leaving this draft with a defenseman we're excited about. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. The board may not play out that way, but you have several high picks. There are players there that merit the pick on talent, and I are hoping, as I think as a fan, that you can get one of those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you look at kind of that grouping, I think Bonk is kind of one of the guys who, you know, coming out of London, 6'1", has put up a little bit of offense, moves well. He could be a guy that I think I could see going maybe closer to 20.
Yeah, I think he's actually closer to 6'2", and I think that's people look at all those tools and that is the one guy who, like, I've mocked him now as low as 29, as high as 18. Maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle there where he actually goes. But I do think there are people in the league who like this player a lot, and I do think he will be a first-round pick.
Give me the selling point for Moran, because I don't know that – I think this was the first time I'd really seen him in a first round for you.
I mean, exceptional offense this season in the queue. I think if you're a good prospect, you're expected to produce good offense in the queue, but he is a defenseman and – you know, giant numbers, both in the regular season, especially in the playoffs, where something ridiculous like a point and a half per game or something for a defenseman in the playoffs, and a ton of goals this season as well. You know, really good skill, hockey sense, you know, excellent shot, one of the better shots in the draft, especially for a defenseman. Might be the best shot for any defenseman in the draft. Skating is fine, I think. It's not a major selling point, especially as a 6'0 guy. It looks a little awkward at times, but other times it looks powerful and could be evasive. So I think his big selling point is that he can provide you a lot of offense, but he may give back a little bit defensively.
And then Molendijk, to your point, I mean, he is not the biggest guy, but I know you've got plus grades on the skating and the compete. And at the end of the day, in the modern NHL, that will take you a long way. For a guy who's not tiny, tiny, he's just not maybe just a hair under 6 foot.
Yeah, and in the mock, I give him to Montreal there at 32. And I wrote in the mock that I kind of analogized Molendijk as a player to a young defenseman that Montreal picked a few years ago in Alexander Romanov. And he only went like a couple of spots later and he was Russian. So I think this is a reasonable range to kind of expect Molendijk to go right around the 30 spot. Maybe it's right at the end of day one, beginning of day two. Exceptional skating defenseman who competes well, has some secondary offense, but he's not a huge offensive guy. And he's not that big either. He's an option there. I think Maxim Sturback is an option there. I think Lukas Dragicevic is an option as a late one. But I don't know how many of these defensemen are extremely exciting guys that you could say are going to be comfortable first round picks.
Yeah, I have to say, if there were two names who I maybe expected to see in the first round here that I ultimately did not, it would be Dragicevic and then Mikhail Guliyev. And I wonder, I mean, we know that there are questions with Dragicevic's kind of overall game, but when you look at the offense that he put up,
yep.
Do you really think teams are going to be able to let him get out of day one?
I think it's people are on the bubble with him just because of the defending issues, and because he wasn't that great. Like, I don't think his start of his U18 Worlds was poor, and then by the end he was playing better, but I don't think he had a great tournament there, a convincing tournament there. Moran didn't either, mind you, but he only played like the two games. But I think he is definitely an option as a late one. I don't think that's unreasonable. And in terms of Guliyev, he's a very difficult player to project because there are some people in the league who are big fans of this player. And there are some who are like, yeah, 5'10", good skating, good skill defenseman, Russian. You know, how many 5'10 guys really play in the league in a significant role? You know, is he dynamic enough to be that next one? Or, you know, is he just kind of like one of those dime a dozen type of players? And I think given the fact that he is still in the KHL as well, I think those are all risk factors that if I was a betting man, I don't think he will be a first round pick just from what I've heard about him all season. But I wouldn't be shocked. I do think there is maybe a minority opinion of him in the league who believe he could be that next great small offensive defenseman.
Well, it was good stuff on the mock. I know it probably will not be your last, but plenty of interesting nuggets in there. I would highly encourage people to check that out. Also, though, I have to go back to what I said at the top of the show. The new formatting for the overall kind of draft board here is really cool, sortable. For me, on mobile, extremely user-friendly. But Corey, I know you're probably most eager to talk about the rankings themselves, more so than the formatting. So I'll let you do that here. You mentioned earlier, you got the two non-Michkov big Russians, the Lokomotiv guys, Daniil Butin and Dmitry Simashev. Both of those guys end up in your final top 10. That is in the top of the lineup tier. And I think as much as we talked about last week, Michkov being the story of the draft, these guys may be like the story that's not getting enough attention of the draft, because if that is the talent level, they could really shake up some maybe projections on draft day.
I tend to agree. And this is not usually not universal opinions around the league, but like most hockey people I talk to agree. If they were playing in the CHL, they are no doubt top 12 guys. Could be, you know, in the case of Boot, you hear no doubt top 8, maybe someone even say up to like 5, essentially in terms of pure talent. Those opinions, you know, can vary, but I think most people in the league think these are premium talents, and they're on standard KHL contracts. This is not Michkov. This is the standard 2-year contract. That's two more years after the draft. Most KHL players are signed through the Rage 19 season on their first contracts. So I think, yeah, exactly where they land is becoming difficult to project. The common thought is teams with multiple picks tend to be the organizations that target these kind of players. You saw that last year with Daniil Yurov, that it was Minnesota who had Liam Ogren in the same draft in round one, targeted Yurov. But it's not a universal rule. Ivan Mirosechenko goes to Washington. They did not have multiple picks, but I think they have a lot of comfort drafting Russians. They sign him shortly thereafter. And I think that's kind of the same thing with Michkov. I think with Michkov, I don't think those rules really apply. I think teams with one pick can swallow that just because of the caliber of talent he is. But you look at Boot and you look at teams of multiple picks, I think of Boot and Simashev, that is. I think of Detroit. I think of St. Louis. I think of Arizona, Nashville. I think those are all organizations that could reasonably take that shot.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned the contract length difference, and it's certainly not uncomplicated just because of the war. But especially when you start getting into 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, are you not talking about a 2-year wait for most of these guys that you're taking? Maybe you're getting Dalibor Dvorsky. Maybe Nate Danielson could be a little quicker. He's an older player. But you are kind of thinking potentially a 2-year wait anyway for these guys.
I agree. But I think one of the variables is the fact that you haven't these teams haven't seen him live this year. The interview process isn't as thorough as would be in previous years. There is still a risk factor in getting them signed. So I think at that point in the draft, you know, top 10, I think I'm fine with the argument of if it's close, take the other guy. Like, is Samuel – I have Boot rated ahead of Samuel Hanzik. Is he that much better than Samuel Hanzik, though? I would say no. So I'm fine with somebody looking at him and saying, yeah, okay, we'll take Hanzik. But then you get to a certain point in the draft where you're like, you know, is he better than Colby Barlow? And I'm like, yeah, in my opinion, by a notable margin. Is he better than Cal Ritchie? I'm like, yes, by a rather significant margin. I just don't think there's anything Ritchie does better than him at hockey. And, you know, there's, and so that I think at that point in the draft, and that could happen in the early teens, and it could happen closer to the mid-teens, I think at some point that margin is just going to become so wide between those two players. Like, there's between, in my opinion, like Dmitry Simashev and like Oliver Bonk is gigantic. Like, you know, this is a 6'2 mobile puck moving defenseman versus a 6'4 mobile puck moving defenseman with like some physicality and some edge in his game. Like, there's it's such a wide gap there. So I think at some point teams will be pressed to take these guys. And I think it could happen fairly early on day one.
The other interesting thing about those two guys, Corey, is in your rankings, you have them at 9 and 10 at the end of that top of the lineup tier. That is ahead of where Ryan Leonard is in your rankings. And I think at least in most of the mocks that have come out, including, I believe, your own mock, certainly I think in mock 2.0 that I just looked at, Leonard is much higher than that. How do you kind of come to Leonard at 11 and what's your thought process there?
Well, the mock is based on where I think they're going to go. And just in discussions with people around the league, I think Leonard is extremely well thought of. And I think he's going to be a very early pick on day one. I think, you know, he will, he has a very good chance, not a lock, but a very good chance to go in the top 10. You know, he's got a ton of skill. He skates well. One of the most competitive players in the draft. He has a really good shot, scored 50 goals for the program this season. He's a great player. I look at him and I still have some, I have minor reservations in his projection. You know, this, he is supposed to be like this super physical competitive player, but he is a slightly below average size for a player in the NHL. And, you know, especially for a guy who would play that kind of play style, I think his hockey sense is good, but I don't think it's a major selling point. I do have some minor questions on, you know, how the offense would translate. And it's no surprise on that extremely loaded top US line with Will Smith and Gabe Perreault, who all scored a bunch this year. You know, his numbers are frankly far below the other two, despite all the opportunities on the top line and top power play. That is a little concerning to me. And so I think he's a really good hockey player. I never got the, okay, I never got the sense watching this year that I could distinguish him as like this truly premium prospect, the guy who's going to have like a major, major impact in an NHL lineup. But I mean, he's on the precipice. He's the next guy listed at the top of the next grouping. So I can see the argument to elevate him for sure.
It is an interesting conversation because when we talk about him as this power forward, he is certainly that at this level. But when he is going against those bigger, faster, stronger defensemen, maybe that is where you get a little bit of worry at, you know, is it 5'11 and a half or 6 foot, whatever it is. That it is harder to play that game when you're not 6'2", 6'3".
Yeah, and that's one where we're going to talk about this in the next segment. But you know, when trying to think of a player comparable for him, I really struggled. Like I ended up on Arturi Lehkonen. You know, I thought of, okay, maybe he's Jason Zucker. You know, maybe he is some. There's some analogies maybe to Seth Jarvis a little bit. But like there aren't a whole lot of guys in the league who look like that, who play that style at that size, but also play like 17, 18, 19 minutes a night.
What about Tyler Bertuzzi?
I mean, that is possible. He's also a guy who, frankly, in his draft year was not for his offense. He barely scored in the OHL in his draft.
And he had injury troubles too. Yep.
Yeah. So that is a reasonable comp there as well. I think, you know, like I said, there are those guys who exist in the league and he's a very good player. Would you call Tyler Bertuzzi a premium player in an NHL lineup, or is he's probably on the precipice, right?
I think, yeah, he's like a top six, but that is the tier that you have him in here. It's not a guaranteed top line thing. So I think that's a fair argument. I just think, like, you know, at first when we were talking about kind of the power forward element, it brought me back to, I think, the conversation we had in the wake of the Tyler Boucher thing about can he be that guy in the NHL? But the obvious difference being, I think Leonard's offense is on a different level than what Tyler Boucher's was.
Yes, I agree. But I think the size is actually quite similar as well as their skating ability. But yeah, I think Leonard's pure skill and goal scoring touches superior.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so that's an interesting one. The other one I want to talk about is Matthew Wood. And really, this is probably the start of a conversation I want to have out of the World U18 tournament. I know Wood has been on the overall radar all year. I remember him being, I think, not too far off this range in the preseason even. But I feel like he maybe got a little lost in the middle of the year in terms of the conversation. But coming out of this U18 tournament, he's solidified, right? Not just a couple spots behind Leonard here at number 14. I want to know what Wood did to kind of solidify that for you.
Well, I mean, I thought he was quite poor at the Hlinka Gretzky in the summer, so that left a lasting impression on me and several others for quite some time. Even when you saw him at UConn, it's tough. He's a you know, a true 17-year-old in college hockey. It's a big level going into the Hockey East as a 17-year-old. But you know, you saw the offense. He actually led his college team in scoring. But not an amazing skater. That's always been known. And I think the big issue with him with watching in college is like, did he compete hard enough? He definitely didn't at the Hlinka. I thought he mailed it in, frankly, in that tournament. And then you kind of watch him at UConn, and, you know, it's a little bit of perimeter stuff. And, you know, he's not, you know, it's his effort's just okay at best some nights. So you're a little concerned about that with the skating. And that's why I kind of had him lower all the year. Then I saw him at the U18s and, frankly, towards the end of the year with UConn as well. And I don't think the effort is great, but I thought it was at least better, you know, tolerable. Like, you know, he's able to win some pucks back. You at least notice him consistently throughout the game. I don't think the compete is an asset in his game, but there was portions of the season where I thought it was a liability. I upgraded that from a liability to, you know, somewhere in the middle. And with from what I saw, you know, frankly, with his first, other than in the summer, his first experience during the actual season against junior age players, as opposed to college age players. And that sold me a little bit better on him.
I think we could ask probably a follow-up there on Tom Molander and David Edstrom. We know they were two of the biggest risers out of the World U18s. But I think the question, you could probably ask this about all three guys, like, is there any overcorrection to this? Because both of those guys are in your top 20. All three of those guys actually in your top 20. Now, Molander to 15, obviously got him mocked at 10, so the league agrees. But is there any fear that this is an overreaction?
I think with Wood, there's more track record. I mean, he led the BCHL in scoring as a 16-year-old, led his college team in scoring as a 17-year-old. Then he has a strong U18 Worlds, has the big frame, has the high-end skill. So I think there's a lot there to like. Again, the skating, the compete, you could talk about that. But I mean, he has the body of work of a top 20, top 15 pick. The other two I think are more interesting. With Willander, I think that was steady progression throughout the season. He was just okay, I thought, in August at the Hlinka. Then November tournament looks interesting. World Junior A Challenge, really positive reviews out of that tournament. February tournament, Five Nations, U18s, he's good there. Strong play of Rogla towards the end of the year, helps lead them towards a championship. Then you have that big tournament in April at the U18s. So I think with him, it was steady progression throughout the season that ended on a very high note. But you saw the tools and the play progress. Like, yeah, I can buy the argument maybe the offense isn't real. I do get it. But I've been sold enough from watching him over the entire season to think that it could be real. Edstrom is the interesting one because I admit I did not really think much of him before the U18 Worlds. And it was watching him there. It's not about just watching him at the U18 Worlds. It's watching him there. And this happens every once in a while. You know, I make mistakes and you watch a guy at a tournament or whenever, and you're like, God damn, I did not see that before. And is it because this is a mirage or did I miss something before? And so you're going back now and watching his J20 shifts. I go back, especially watch his SHL shifts where I thought he actually looked quite good with Frölunda in the, whatever, the 10, 12 games he played in the SHL. You're seeing, okay, I undergraded the skating. I didn't know his skill was this good. And now you're starting to say, okay, now he's 6'3 and he can skate. He has a little bit of skill and he competes hard. You're like, okay, these are a lot of pieces that are coming together that he showed consistently at the U18 Worlds, but that I did not give him credit for his play with Frölunda and in both the J20 SHL level. I've gotten some pushback on this one in the league. There are people who think I have him too high, but I have talked to people who think he is going to go right around that 20 spot as well.
Well, it's funny because you mentioned the kind of like going back, and I remember earlier in the season we would talk about Otto Stenberg. I want to say that you would be like, look, it's not even that he's not the leading scorer on the team that was or of the age group that was Noah Dover Nilsson. Wasn't Edstrom also ahead of Stenberg in scoring for that team?
For Frölunda's J20 team, yes.
Yeah. So that's one of those cases maybe where you see it in person, you see it at this big event. And you go back and you start to put other pieces together, right? Like maybe you didn't see these traits, but it all starts to kind of make sense, right?
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, there's a reason he led that team in ice time at that tournament. It's because he was, frankly, their best player. I think at the February tournament, actually, he was the second leading player in ice time for one center. Felix Nielsen was actually their top center. I think where Nielsen lands is actually a whole other interesting debate because I think he would have had a really big U18 Worlds if he had gone there too, playing with Rogla as well. On, you know, with Willander, but I think Edstrom, like I said, I think Edstrom for me, it wasn't just one tournament that convinced me, although it helped a lot. It was the extra work I did on top of watching him there that I am finding things that I might have missed before that persuaded me primarily.
Good stuff. We're gonna take a quick break right there and we're gonna come back. I want to talk to you about some of the player comparables here.
No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. Whether you're sending emails or writing a Slack message, the last thing you want is a grammatical error. It just looks unprofessional. Just a little bit of help from Grammarly can make a big impact on your work day to day. 96% of Grammarly users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. It works across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, tone suggestions help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Save time with one click and go from editing drafts in hours to seconds. 93% of professionals using Grammarly Premium report that it helps them get more work done. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
All right, we are back. And Corey, among the many elements of the rankings are something you started doing a year or two ago, where you add a player comparable for most of the top 30 to 40 or so players. And I want to ask you about a few of them, especially on the top guys. And right at the top of the board, we got Connor Bedard. You've got him compared to David Pastrnak. It was funny. I don't know if it was a commenter. I think it might have been one of the comments on the story said, like, if he's Pastrnak, is that a disappointment considering what the hype was? I thought that was a really interesting, I mean, David Pastrnak was high on my MVP ballot this year, but I wanted to kind of know a little bit more about how you come to these comparables. And then I kind of want your answer to that question.
Yeah, I would probably push back on a guy. What do you have, 60 goals, 100 something points this year? Yes. Yeah, no, I think if Bedard does that even one season, I think you're thrilled to have that kind of offensive talent. The most difficult comps for me, both this year and last year, happen at the very, very top. Because at the very, very top, you're projecting these guys, you know, understandably, to be among the better players in the league. You're projecting an impact talent. And there are so few impact talents in the league that it's kind of hard to find the perfect comparable. You know, if you think Bedard is a center, you think of the small premium centers in the league. It's like, okay, is he Braden Point? No. Like, he has far more skill than Braden Point does. He has a much better shot than Braden Point does. You know, Braden Point probably has a little bit more competitiveness than this guy does. Doesn't mean that Braden Point isn't skilled and can't score. And it doesn't mean that Bedard isn't competitive, but those player styles just don't mesh at all. It's like, okay, is he Sidney Crosby? It's like, no, not really. Like, Sidney Crosby has out of this world hockey sense and vision. You know, he's such a monster competitively. I just don't see that analogy there between the two, especially with the goal scoring element. Even though Sidney has a great shot, just not, again, the player comps don't mesh there. Jack Hughes is this unbelievable skater, and that's just not what Bedard is. He's a good skater, but he's not an unbelievable skater. He's not one of the top 5-10 skaters in the league like Jack Hughes is. So you run out of center comps already. There's not that many centers who look like him. And now, talking about wings, because there's a chance Bedard is a wing in the NHL. I think Chicago, given their absolute lack of center depth, have to try him at center. But when they're ready to contend in maybe 4 or 5 years, is he for sure going to be playing the middle for them? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see how it goes. And Pastrnak isn't a perfect comp for him either. I mean, he's 6'0", 6'1". Bedard's under 5'10". Like, that's a pretty significant size gap. But the reason why I chose Pastrnak is, you know, for me, the two big elements of Bedard's game is game-breaking skill and game-breaking shot. And I think with Pastrnak, he has both of those elements in his game while being a good, not amazing skater. And yeah, the compete isn't the same between the two of them. I think Bedard competes harder. I think the size element isn't the same. But and that's why it's so hard to find a couple for the very best guys. But I thought in terms of those major, major assets, the way they score, I thought that was the line to draw there.
I think for me, the guy who always comes up is Patrick Kane, but it is a good point. With Kane, it might be more the skill and the playmaking so than the skill and the pure shot, which would tend to turn Pastrnak.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that was why I didn't choose Kane either, is because even though they're similar frames, good, not elite skaters, you know, Kane is, you know, an elite passer, and I don't think Bedard is a good passer, really good passer, actually, but I don't think he is Patrick Kane level in that kind of creativity as a playmaker. And it's the same reason why I didn't choose Michkov comp as Kane either, because I think there's a temptation to do that there too. But like, one guy is an absolute pure goal scorer, and the other guy is like a pure passer.
Do you have a policy against reusing comps? Because I actually feel like you could have used, and it's funny because I don't think Michkov and Bedard are one for one, but I think you could have used Pasternak for Michkov even, although Pasternak a little more size.
Yeah, I think you could have, yes. It was. I see the argument either way. I really struggled finding a Michkov comp, and I think, frankly, this is part of the debate around him in the league, is it's not just the contract. It's not just the fact that he's, you know, in Russia and there's the war going on. It's that this is this, you know, it's hard to think of like a recent star in the NHL in my lifetime who looks like him, who is, you know, barely 5'10", doesn't have amazing foot speed, is not like this warrior in terms of his compete level, but it's just going to blow you away with his offensive skill and goal scoring ability. Like, that guy doesn't really exist in the league that I can think of. You know, I chose Kucherov for him. I didn't love it, because I do think Kucherov does have a little bit more of a passing instinct in his game. Although you see the way he runs the top power play for Tampa, he has a really good shot too. And the reason I chose Kucherov is I just think because of the frames, the good, not amazing skating. Even though I think Kucherov's a better skater, he's a much better competitor than Michkov is. But I think just the what really drove it for me is I just think both of their hockey senses are just so special. And Kucherov, when he was younger, was a little bit more of a goal scorer. So that's why I connected those dots there a little bit. It wasn't just the Russian variable there. But I would say Michkov, frankly, has more skill than Kucherov. At least they did at the same age. So it's the question with Michkov is just going to be, will it translate? If he can't play, can he play an NHL pace? Can he handle NHL physicality? Will it translate? I had a friend of mine make an analogy to, you know, because there's no comp to him in the NHL. One comp I thought of that made actually a lot of sense is, if you're a football fan who was following the NFL draft, you know, there was no comp for Bryce Young in the NFL, yeah. Right? Like there was no guy who looked like that. He's the, you know, an average athlete at best for the NFL, you know, really undersized, not an elite runner, et cetera, but he had off the chart intelligence. You know, that's kind of like a similar situation here where, you know, there's a lot of risk on the player comp, but but you just are so blown away by the talent and the intelligence. So yeah, I debated Kane, I debated Kucherov, did not think of Pasternak there, but that's actually not an unreasonable one to use.
Well, so my other question, you bring up the compete. Kucherov's draft year predates me paying attention, but was his compete always like an asset for him, or was there ever a period where you could kind of draw a line there? Could Michkov grow into this, basically, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I don't remember it being like the super elite trait, but I remember it being good. I think the issue was just that he was small, good, not great skater back then. Like, I think Tampa really benefited in a couple of year span. It's like you kind of saw it in 2010 when Tarasenko won 16, probably the closest analogy I'm ever going to find to the Michkov situation.
Yeah.
Because he was considered a consensus top five player on talent at the time. You know, he goes 16 and Kuznetsov went in the 20s. At that time, the KHL scare was really prominent. The league had just been founded from the Russians, you know, transitioning over from the Russian Super League. You know, they looked like a very powerful entity that were going to try and compete with the NHL for talent. Teams got scared. Tarasenko falls, Kuznetsov falls. And then Vasilevsky, who looked like this unbelievable goalie prospect, falls to 19. Kucherov, who I think most people knew, and I think if you even ask Tampa, they know, the league knew this was a really good player. Maybe not, they didn't know he was going to be this good, but they knew he was a good player. He falls to the second round. They take the gamble. It works out. I think they benefited from it just being this unique situation where there's always been hesitancy on taking Russians, but it was just really high there at the time.
Yeah. So we talk all the time about kind of how at the very top of the draft, you know, there can be steep steps down from the first pick to the second pick to the third pick to the fourth pick, right? And I think you kind of see that in the comps here, because we go from talking about the Pasternaks and the Kucherovs to a guy who we think could go as high as, you know, as potentially three, but almost certainly top five here. Leo Carlson's comp is Tomáš Hertl, outstanding player, but I don't think we talk about Hertl in the same breath that we talk about Pasternak and Kucherov.
Right, and then Will Smith's is Evgeny Kuznetsov. Again, right. You know, both are star centermen in the NHL, really important players on their teams, but yeah, different caliber of talents. Hurdle's comp for Carlson is one I struggled with, because You know, for a while there, we thought my comps for him were wingers. I debated Mikko Rantanen. I debated Matt Boldy. Very different caliber of players there. Not that Matt Boldy isn't a great player, but Mikko Rantanen is a superstar. And there was a time I thought Carlson could reach that caliber. I lowered it a little bit. Like, I think maybe Rantanen was too aggressive. Maybe Hurdle doesn't fully capture the degree of offense Carlson has. I don't think it's completely out of whack. Hurdle is still, you know, sat around a point per game for several seasons in the NHL. He's a great player, and there is a positional aspect to it too. Yes, you know, Kucherov is an incredible offensive talent, definitely a superior player to Hurdle. But Hurdle does play a very valuable position in the NHL. He is a first line center in the NHL. That is extremely valuable. We've rehashed this several times, the Mishkov debate and the issues at hand and the talent we're talking about. I do think there's a significant talent drop off. But you know, if you can get, you know, like a guy you think could be Thomas Hurdle in a standard draft is going like second or third overall typically.
Yeah, and that is kind of the testament to what you always talk about with, you know, when people talk about a above average draft, a great draft, we're mostly talking about the very top of it. And if you're getting a potential, I mean, I think Leo Carlson, you know, should probably go three or four, but if there's a world where he would get to five, you're thrilled at five. Montreal would be thrilled with that outcome. And I think honestly, Columbus or San Jose would be, you know, it is kind of funny if Carlson were to get to San Jose, they get a Thomas Hurdle replacement there.
You think of like Carlson being five in like 2019, where Turcotte goes five, or 2020, where Ken Johnson goes five. I mean, he's way ahead of those guys at the same age.
Absolutely. Barrett Hayton to Arizona goes five in 2018. Yeah. The other guy who might go five is David Reinbacher. We think kind of cementing himself as the top D in the draft. And you have his comp as Brett Pesce. This I thought was very interesting because I remember a few years back in the early kind of should Toronto trade Nylander dramas. I think that the conversation was always, oh, Nylander for Pesce or whatever. And Pesci's certainly a top four D on one of the best teams in the NHL. I wonder what the reception would be to the idea of Brett Pesce going top five in a draft.
That is a comment I've gotten from a few readers, even a few people in the league. It's like, you know, do you really think Brett Pesce would be a top 10 pick in a draft? And I think the answer is yes. I think, you know, he plays major minutes on a top team. He's, you know, big, mobile, competitive player. Not a premier offensive guy, but when they needed, you know, when they need to use him on a power play, they can. He gets his points. He looks like a really valuable player. I think if he would have been, you know, I think he's almost up there with Carolina, but if he would have hit the open market, I think last season, what is he been getting paid? $7 million?
Yeah, I think he's $7 million plus player. Yep.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's top of the lineup players in my opinion. And I think that's, you always kind of have to calibrate what the draft really is. And in the draft, there's usually two, three, maximum this year, a little bit more, but usually two or three absolute no doubters. Then you have 8, 9, 10 guys you'll feel pretty good about are going to have NHL careers. And then there's like 20 to 25 other guys who you think are going to have NHL careers, but there's this and that issue that could prevent it. You know, to me, Reinbacher's in that second group. He is a guy who I think feel pretty confident he's going to have an NHL career. And that doesn't mean he's going to be a superstar. He could be, but probably won't be. But if you get Brett Pesce out of a draft, that's a top pair defenseman. It may not be a superstar. I know everybody wants superstars when they draft in the top five, top 10, but that's not frankly realistic. The last time Montreal drafted this high, they got Jesperi Kotkaniemi. Would they rather have Kotkaniemi or Brett Pesce?
Right. Yeah, and, you know, you can dream on getting the Zach Werenski, but if you gave someone the choice today between Brett Pesce and Ivan Provorov, they're taking Pesce.
Yep, I agree with that too.
Yeah, so that's interesting. A couple other guys that we're talking mostly here about the top of the draft, but there was a couple interesting ones more in your kind of late teens that I wanted to get to. A couple guys who, you know, I think maybe slightly similar conversations in Braden Jaeger and Oliver Moore. I think maybe more certainty that Moore is going to stick at center long term. But in terms of guys on the smaller end whose maybe big traits are their skating and their scoring, the comps here I thought were pretty different.
Yep.
Travis Konecny for Braden Jaeger. I think that speaks to the positional element, and JG Pajot for Oliver Moore. I wanted to hear how you kind of approach finding the comps. I know you had talked about Alex Newhook in the past for Moore.
Right. And I had some pushback on that from our firm readers who didn't want guys who really hadn't established themselves as NHLers yet, which I think was perfectly reasonable. The issue with Moore, with Jaeger, with Sand and Pelka too, and trying to find a confirm is that there's only so many 5'11 guys in the NHL, right? So you run, if it doesn't fit, you run out of them essentially. And with Moore, the reason I think he gets like a center is because even though I think Jaeger skates quite well, you know, Moore's a dimensional skater, and I think it gives him a better chance to stick down the middle in the NHL. Not everybody in the league frankly agrees. There are detractors who think this is just going to be like a third line energy winger. I don't think that's the consensus opinion, but those opinions do exist out there. I think a lot of people think he can stick down the middle. And frankly, there are people in the league who think Jaeger can stick down the middle because he's got really good skating, really good compete. He's intelligent. He's played the middle, you know, for a long time, including he was the number one center for Canada at the Holinka. So I think there's a hope he can be a center in the NHL. But I think that's where I kind of split the difference there. I think because Moore's skating is so exceptional at that size that it gives him the chance to be a Jean-Gabriel Pajot type of two-way center, presuming the compete looks as good in the pros as it has in junior.
And ultimately, Pajot, I think people will see third line center, but this is a player who plays a big role on a team that went to consecutive conference finals. If you look at what he was traded for a couple of years ago, that tells you what the league thinks of him.
Yeah, no, he's an excellent player. But, you know, do I think Moore's for sure going to reach that caliber of player? I wouldn't say for sure, but again, there's always so many guys I can choose from who play that way. And it's why I chose Newhook, because I actually thought that the lines were pretty well done there between the skating, the size, the compete, the good, not great offensive touches. But Newhook has, you know, still established himself as an NHL player. He barely played for Colorado in the playoffs, so I didn't think that was a fair one to compare him to.
Yeah, really good stuff. Would highly encourage everybody to go check out that new draft ranking and Corey's mock draft 2.0. But in the meantime, that is going to do it for us. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Athletic Hockey Show's Prospect Series. You can follow us on YouTube at youtube.com/@TheAthleticHockeyShow. And right now, you can get a one-year subscription to The Athletic for $2 a month when you visit theathletic.com/hockeyshow. Talk to you soon.